Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and video show which brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, and experience from literally hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. If you're new to the channel, please subscribe so you won't miss a new episode. I'm your host, Fritz Bussemaker, and today I'm delighted and privileged to have a conversation with Paul Infante Monocha. Paul, welcome to the program.
Welcome, Fritz. Thank you for having me.
Paul, let me briefly introduce just a little bit of the background for our audience. You chair the Family Office, a foundation which is one of the leading global philanthropical organizations since 2003. Its origin is from the Philippines, but you're now based in Monaco, France. And you're also one of the leading private sector-led universal basic income platforms, which I find fascinating. That's going to be a main topic. That's the Family Office. But what I also see is a background that you actually were, say, the inventor of the architecture of the world's first cross-border fund transport and payment system. So I just wanted to figure out how significant that is. Now, you've not always been in the Family Office. You've also worked for Singapore-based companies like Quaker Oats, Siemens, and also McLaren, Mercedes, which sounds like quite a fascinating place to work with. And for the audience, we met because we're both involved in the Be Pure initiative, the ban for political use of religion. We'll cover that briefly. But first of all, again, thank you for to join us for The Brand Called You.
Thank you. Thank you, Fritz. Happy to be here.
Well, for those of in the audience who do not know what a family office is, what do you do? Can you maybe briefly explain what you're doing?
Okay, well, a family office is a structure. I would say it's still a new structure because that really just surfaced around, around 2010 and beyond. Before that, I think structures of any family-related organizations, especially the protection of assets, would exist in either structures around trusts or foundations or multiple corporates. So I think the family office structure is still new. And we shifted to a family office structure, not only as a tax structure, but being able to see how it provides a more transparent identity, I would call it. And mind you, I'm actually describing this as a person which spent more than half of my life in corporate finance and philanthropic fund management. And my previous life was with a Big Four, PricewaterhouseCoopers. I think family offices have evolved so much. If you were to define it within the European context, I think it's more flexible. The identity of that would not only exist within, entities around, government organizations, but it can even exist within banks itself, within the trust departments of banks itself. When you look at it in a more detailed manner, you would look at family offices in structures like Singapore, let's say London, New York, and you'd look at it that there are certain parameters that a family office has. For example, within Asia, you would have to have at least 70 to 100 million US in liquid assets to be able to really, deem you as a real family office. There's a lot of family offices out there which are not really family offices. And then second, you would be able to see that, when the identity of the family office is really something which is really impactful to what they do, whether it's for pure profit or sub-profit venture philanthropy like us. You would look at family offices with a tremendous history, including family foundations are part of it. It's all because when families have a real advocacy to be able to do something good for the world, you would see that. So for those who really shake family offices, well, you would really see that they don't have any backgrounds there, right? You know, so I think that's second. And then I think for third, it's really more continuity and sustainability. I would say this in some events where, you know, they would invite me to speak about certain things. And I would, one of the key messages is I hope that family offices are not a fad. And the reason for that is, you know, there seems to be some creative people in the finance world where, you know, they come up with all sorts of nice names and nice orgs to be able to escape certain things. But you see, when you talk now of a family office, like for us, our family name is pegged to the family office, so you would know who we are. You know, this is not some blind fund, you know, where it's investing quietly here and there without any form of presence, visibility, background from the family itself. So I think that's the definition of family office. So in other parts of the world, actually, they don't even understand what a family office is. They think a family office is a family business. And so that's completely, you know, not true. So family office is a new structure. It's a structure which I think provides more transparency, visibility with who you're dealing with, because you're not pegging yourself to one person. You're pegging themselves to the history of that family. And funds can change left and right, whether you call them fund of funds or whatever, you know, that can change, but you cannot change who the family is, you know. And I think that's what, besides having the size metrics, the value of the assets under management and whatever, at the end of the day, it gives more visibility, transparency to who you're dealing with. I think that's more valuable for a lot of people. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, thank you for that explanation, Paul. Before we continue with exploring what you as a family office are doing at the moment, what I found quite fascinating when I went to the website is how prominent also your history, your parents, your grandparents are in the picture. That's almost the first thing you see. And
go ahead. Yeah.
I was just wondering, can you explain a little bit, take us a little bit how you grew up? How well did you know your parents and your grandparents?
Okay, well, thank you very much. We come from a very small family on both sides. On the Infante side and the Monyosca side, I think we're quite, my mother was the only child, and I don't have any first cousins on my mother's side. On my father's side, I have one first cousin. So most of my family members are second or third cousins. And it has its advantages and disadvantages, I think, during, you know, family lunches and dinners. But I think we put a lot of emphasis on what not only my parents, but I think our advocacies have been through the years. And I am third gen. So at the end of the day, we want to be able to have the notable milestones in what we do, which I think lends a lot of credibility on how we progress moving forward. So my father was a doctor. He was a surgeon. My grandparents were doctors. So we come from a family of doctors. We have cousins, you know, who are doctors. So it's been a very medically driven family. So you could understand why we have a foundation. It's because, you know, it started off with the simple medical missions, being able to, you know, treat people in far-flung areas. And it was who we were, you know, in service of humanity, basically. And here I come, being quite a lost boy before, during my university years, and I thought that I could be in the same realm as my parents and my grandparents. I think all of us has had our own sacrifices. My parents, my grandparents, they have had their own sacrifices together with myself. So I don't think there's any family which just sailed smoothly through the years. Right? It was quite a learning experience for me. I was able to realize that I couldn't be a doctor. It wasn't for me. And I'm glad that my father actually made me realize that early. And so as I say, I was quite a lost boy during university years. Didn't know what I was doing. I loved sports, so I got involved in my early years with sports, multinational companies like Gatorade, owned by Quaker. I was head of sports marketing for what they were doing. I moved to Siemens, which was sponsoring the McLaren Mercedes F1 during the time of Mika Hakkinen. I went through that route, and for some weird reason, some guys in corporate finance and investment banking felt that I should join them because I was friends with some people that they wanted to do business with for years, and they never got to do that. And I had to basically really study again and be able to get trained. So I was not a trained finance professional from the start. I had to catch up. Right. But when I did, yes, you know, that's, I guess, where I blossomed. I felt that being a deal maker in my early years, that was what I wanted to do. I tried a little bit of private banking and wealth management during that time, but I felt that doing deals was the way to go. And then it evolved into what I'm doing today, which is on philanthropic funds and being able to create legacies and footprints for families, including ours. So we have a single family office, and then we have a multifamily office. I'm still very humbled and honored to have, you know, a very very good families and influential families provide a trust and be able for me to be a part of their legacy. So let's just say I took the long route. I was not someone who was, when they talk to me now, they think I just had it smooth sailing. No, I didn't. I took the long route. So that's my, you know, long and short, Rich, that's my background. I think we would need more hours if I tell you what went on behind that.
Okay, no, I can assume a bumpy road in what you've described. Now, I want to cut to the chase and have you talk a little about the, one of the things I've seen as a core of your business is universal basic income. What is this concept?
Okay, thank you for that. That started probably around 2015, 2016. I have a knack for looking beyond the horizon, really, being able to piece together certain things which goes on in our world. And if you really look at it, you were already seeing a lot of news, both factual and false. So you needed to really dwell on what the truth was. And long and short of that is there is such a thing called singularity. And by rights called technological singularity. And people don't realize that before you even talk about ESG, you talk about all the rest of these other classifications and where you want to put money in, right? You have to be able to understand the repercussions of singularity. Singularity, for those who don't know about it, is a point where humanity and artificial intelligence meet. And AI basically overtakes humanity. That is beyond what you call generative AI. So it moves into the super intelligent AI status. Together with that, that is coupled with what you call quantum computing, which means that the future is a mere request can provide you facts and truths 100 years before you were even born, right? Because it basically reads everything. It enforces legal claims. It is able then to correct history. And I was very fascinated about it from the very start. Of course, I was, like anyone, quite skeptical about what it could do. But I knew that it was getting scary. And I zeroed in into the monetary system. And when I was looking at this, I think it was around 2018 where I had a bunch of my people saying we should invest in this. And really during that time, I said, no, I just want to think about it. I just want to contemplate about it. And I had some good people with me. I have to admit that one, two of them even argued the case with me. And it's not easy to argue with me, really, you know. And for them to do that, I actually appreciated that. And so I never took it off my plate. Come 2018, for some reason, a lot of the good people I worked with was experiencing problems with the growth of their wealth, right? And when we say growth of wealth, well, this is not money laundering. This is not, being able to move money cross border in large amounts. And no. This is about if controls are very much tight in every part of the world, then you're looking at what you call decentralization. And decentralization expands from there, being able to say that opportunities are going to tighten up. So although so much as humanity travels and wants to become global citizens, you're going to be pushed back to where you came from, right? Because investments are only controlled by a few. It is a fact that less than 1% of the world's wealthy control 70% of the world's wealth. So those numbers stuck in my head since that time, because I felt that that was not leading to peace, that was leading to war, right? And gone are the days of, colonial mentalities and thinking that several countries rule the world and control humanity in that sense. But you see, decentralization is not the choice of the powers that be. It is the choice of humanity and AI. So we can only hope that AI doesn't go rogue, because then it serves humanity. If AI goes rogue, then you'll have an attack at all fronts, however you want to interpret that in what's happening today. Right? There's a lot of things which don't make sense today. So the UBI program really stemmed in 2018 when I had to be able to really seriously commit to solving and addressing a problem. And that problem was, if people start losing jobs because of AI, because of automation, because the world's wealthy is just a few bunch of people, and if something happens to that, you would have no value system moving around in whatever form, considering that only 15% are in your ATMs, 85% is reserved cash, right? So I already was seeing that. And of course, you think of yourself as who the hell am I to trying to do and trying to solve that, right? So, but I think, you know, you tend to realize what you can do and what you cannot do, and be able to say a prayer and say that, but this is what I want to do, right? So I spoke to some of the family officers, which was with me. And I said that if it leads to chaos, there is no money to be made anymore,
yeah.
Right? Together with that, you would see your portfolios dwindle in value because you can't even use it. You can't, if you wanted to acquire a company which would give you an IRR of 30% to 40% in another part of the world, but the company would cost you $1 billion, but you can't even transfer $5 million, what do you think is going to happen? Then you don't get the deal. Right. So that was how simple it was in terms of the family offices looking at target opportunities across the world. Right. And then, of course, here comes YouTube and YouTube being able to provide information, whether true or false, but it's uncensored. Right. Only recently did they start censoring it. Yes, but you have still, if you needed to get a message across and none of the mainstream media would cover it, you could always go to YouTube. You could always go to somewhere else, right, on the internet. Then that's coupled with the advent of digital assets, which I never believed in from the start. I mean, the first time I heard about Bitcoin, I said the world is bonkers. And that evolved, and then now you have Web3 and metaverses. But on the digital asset side, you have a lot of scams. So you didn't know where it was leading, really. But then, if people realize really objectively the technologies, there is not one, there is not two, there are five types of cryptocurrencies, right? So the scams are happening on the exchanges, not the cryptocurrencies. I call it transactional cryptos. Bitcoin, ETH are transactional. Not backed by anything, but it is backed by the trust of the people and some liquidity pool which was put in there. Then you have ICOs and IEOs, initial coin offerings, which I totally stay away from because that doesn't have basically a bunch of startups raising money. But it's better just to get a check from the company and be able to deposit in your account. Why go the long route, right? Then you have the stable coins, which I think have done wonders in being able to expand the use of it and hopefully become secondary or tertiary currencies, quasi currencies to full currencies. But stable coins are in danger because of central bank digital currencies. CBDCs are issued by governments and central banks, and they are pegged to fiat and cash, or the basket of currencies, they call it, which is exactly the same position in a stable coin. So stable coins, for me, are threatened. And I don't know if it can survive because you're up against what government and central banks want to do. Now, we still live in a society, right? Decentralization, everyone wants that. People want to be able to be free, democratic, or whatever, be able to do what they want to do. But the reality is we live in a country where there is society and government. So to what point can you decentralize, right? Especially in our lifetime, even in the next generation, up to what point can you decentralize? Now, the fifth area of cryptocurrencies is RWA. So that's where we play in real world assets, which means that every single digital asset we have is backed by something physical. We specialize in energy, precious metals, some level of marine reserves, protection of forest cover, environment related mandates. And the newest one is actually avatar data. So we feel that humanity itself has value down the road in an AI related setting. So And we feel that RWAs are the future because it's tokenization, which means that it provides the opportunity to trade the value of your physical assets. Although, of course, it's a gray area when it comes to people and companies declaring RWA status, but really have nothing to back it with. But it is the leading contender of tandems with CBDCs. Go ahead, Fritz. Yeah.
Okay. So just to put that in perspective that people realize, if I understand you correctly and look at the website, you currently have over 1 trillion assets under tokenization. Is that correct?
Yeah. This year. Yeah.
Okay. Well, 1 trillion. That is a very significant amount of money.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
let's make that link. So that's the assets you manage, but how do you then provide a link to the universal basic income? And who is this income meant for? Because I read on the website, you want to support over 1 billion people by 2040.
Yeah.
Who are those people? Where do they live? And how do you see them getting that? What does it look like?
Yeah. So let me just the valuations of our financial instruments, in this case it is in RWA cryptos, is based on the tokenization of certain physical resources. And the physical resources are packaged in either above the ground or below the ground. So, which means that I could have a concession with a proven reserves report, which says that it's worth this much, but I can't peg my assets to an indicative report, which just says I may have this much. So we're only pegging on proven reserves, or if it is really indicative, we discount it from there. Now, the reason why it was packaged as UBI is because I feel that the future of banking and finance is an institution which understands that people need to have a dividend on the value of not only their citizenship, but on the very country that they sit on. The reason why that was not possible before, you see, universal basic income has actually been a term used by government. And if you look at it, everyone says that no one can set up a UBI program of the government. And the reason for that is corruption. There's no other way to say it. Why? Because you need to peg your currency on your natural resources. So if you get the natural resources for yourself and not for the people, then UBI can't exist. But what we've done is we've said there is no definition where UBI is only government. It says it was started by government. So what we've done is we've said, is there something against a private sector-led universal basic income? There's not. So we said, okay, so if we are able to just focus, let's say, on some key area so that some people don't deem UBI as communism because they think, oh, UBI is like, we're going to give you salary, you don't need to work right away. That's such a dumb way of looking at it, right? We just want to be able to subsidize. So subsidize meaning education, healthcare, microfinance. That's just where we're starting. We're not promising the whole world, right? However, we're targeting key areas. Energy is definitely number one in the future. And that's why there's a thing called the Kardashev scale, because civilizations evolved because of energy. So we needed to peg new energy sources, which could back up solar, let's say, which could back up hydrogen. What is the future, you know, of space travel, let's say? So this is where the questions were. The second thing was precious metals, of course. But precious metals is a subjective lot right now, actually including gold. And then so forth and so on. So the UBI is basically saying banks before, when you set up a bank, you need the banks get the funds from other places, right? Central bank, sovereign wealth funds, whoever wants to put in money in the bank then is able then to lend that out and make money from the interest. So they do loans, they do guarantees, they do this and that. They take savings from people, both corporate and individual, and they buy into fixed income, bonds, whatever you want. And then all of a sudden, you see all these news saying that banks are closing down, including large-scale banks like Credit Suisse. And then, of course, you ask yourself, how do banks close down? Is it because they bought the wrong insurance or bonds? No. The banks closed down because of massive withdrawals. So the question then is, who's withdrawing in massive amounts? Right? But I'll stop there. And then from there, we concluded, of course, I myself is an advocate of being said, so what does the future of banking look like? So the future of banking will look like a bank has to enable a certain portion of deposits, of assets, or whatever it handles for the benefit of the people. And when we say benefit of the people, Switzerland actually introduced that. It's called the WIR bank. But they did it in such a way where it was just really Switzerland and it's not global. And I think that they could have done a lot more in being able to educate others that it was possible. But then the Swiss system has been quite different from every other system. So the WIR bank is able to provide you with a quasi currency, which could back any form of shortfall if you lack money to pay for certain things, right? So then it doesn't give society and humanity the desperation until it gets there. So we packaged in UBI like that. So the bank enables certain wealth management to say that X amount of this has to go to a UBI. How do we identify UBI recipients? So we started small. We started by being able to monetize it through seeds for farmers, right? And that's in our grassroots website, videos on recipients thanking us, all these, it's all there. And then we moved into food packs, right? And then we moved into some level of education, technical education. And then we moved into some level of cash grants, let's say. How are they identified? So they are identified in all sorts of ways. I have to admit that initially the system was that we would identify it based on relationships we had. If a mayor or governor of a town or a city or a friend says, you know, we got hit by a typhoon here, please, you know, what can you do to help us? You know, that sort of thing. That's just how it started. Today, there's a system where it's called a custodian system. So custodians hold and decide for certain level of resources for us, and they are accountable for that. And then it's now, you know, moving towards other parts again as a backup system. Now, anyone who's thinking that we want to take over the monetary system, don't kid yourselves. We don't intend to do that. But we do want to be able to be of assistance to our people. And the people are understanding under our educational system that there are only certain limitations and uses to the UBI. So if we say you can use it in this education platform or in this, that's where you can use it. You can't use it to buy a car, let's say, but you know, but it may reach there. You know? Okay. So that is in a nutshell how it's working today, and what's very encouraging is just the past year and a half, it has had a tremendous surge worldwide, actually. Yeah.
Great. Hey, hearing you talk about UBIs, how it's set up and how it can be used, just wondering what's driving you. Where do you find your inspiration to focus so much to get this off the ground?
I have wanted to quit three times doing this because at the early stages, you had critics who wasn't even doing 10% of what you were doing, but was, you know, trying to do it in their own way, which I think wasn't the best way. And we managed through the years to be able to remain strong and now quite formidable, I think. So where how it works is that there are several councils within the bank. The councils identify the target recipients, and you can someone can always reach out to any one of the council members, right? And when we look at a certain recipient, we are quite objective that the recipient deserves some level of help, but we educate them and tell them, this is what you can do with it, these are the limitations of it, and these are things which you should not do with it. And so far, it's evolving from there. And so when someone, let's say, says, I need help here, how can we help? And we look at it, and so that person then is accorded the resources in the form that we ask them to receive it, let's say. Oh. And then from there, they yes, go ahead, Fritz.
Oh, no, Paul, just wondering. I mean, you're so, I would say, passionate about how you can help people. Just trying to figure out where this passion come from. What makes why not sit on a beach and enjoy the sun? Why are you
I have to admit that as I'm saying, I almost quit 3 times. And some reason every time I would quit, I wanted to quit, the waves roll higher, there were signs that I needed to continue to do it. And that there was, I feel, a guiding hand which said, you know, you have to do this, right? Because if you don't do it, there will be too many people which would suffer. And the kind of setup we have, I don't think can be replicated by anyone that easily, you know. So it's been passionate, yes, but not without you know, the challenges. Yeah,
I understand that. And I might be too simplistic, but the fact that you come from a family of doctors, people who want to help you, to what extent has that formed what you're doing? So you weren't able to become a doctor, but are you now using your financial background to still provide help to people? Is that what made you who you are today, or is that too simplistic?
That would be the basics of it all. That's your driver's license, right? It's that attitude to be part of the family, you know, the family realm where you say we want to be of service, you know. That's the basic, but I think it's sort of gone far beyond that.
I very much see that.
Yeah.
So are there any people in your area you talk to? Where do you get your inspiration from? Is that from talking to people, from books, from family?
I read a lot. I observe a lot. I'm a very observant person, but I listen. So I listen to the world. I listen what's going on around me. I keep quiet and listen. Right? So I may be talkative here because you're doing a nice interview, but really the kind of person I am is I'm extremely observant. So I look, I analyze, I hear, and for some reason there's a certain level of process and thought process which enables me to learn from that.
Okay.
Right. And silence, and I think listening to the world around us is just something that people should appreciate far more.
Well, I'm going to have two more topics to briefly cover with you.
Sure.
As mentioned at the beginning, we know each other through Be Pure, the ban of political use of religion. What did you see when you came across that initiative?
It was started by a good man, right? So Salam Sarhan, I think that he was very sincere in what he wanted to do. And when I was invited to look at it and get involved, I saw that I said this platform can grow very fast. Not only is it timely today, it has you know, it hits out at the very essence of a key problem on peace, right? And it just really needs more, a much bigger voice. It just needs the right programs around it to put people on the table and shake hands and create peace. So I think DPure is getting there. I think it's moving very fast. But you know, you have some people like us, like me, which could be more vocal about things, which I think it doesn't need to be too detailed, but be able to stand up and say this is what we believe in, and that's why we're there, right? And I think that universal basic income, if you look at who really even believes in it, there's really a lot of good people who understand that, right? And even governments, those who really care for people, understand, stop forcing people to be resilient if they're not, because the system is messed up and we need to be able to evolve into a hybrid system, right? Everything changes. I mean, what was happening before, that's not applicable today. Right? And I think that's where, you know, I think I'm fixated actually on expanding the UBI more through the BPure. But again, I am just one of the many characters there as an ambassador. And I'm hoping that, you know, that they would look at it and be able to support it more and provide more access to key markets, and we could value add in that, because you know we also have our tentacles in certain places. So I think it's a good mix, and we're glad you're there, Fritz. I was very happy when you came on board, and you know, and are driving things. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for spending a little bit of time on BPure. I want to end with one final question for me, and that is,
yeah,
what's your advice to the young people out there on their journey? What would you tell them?
Thank you for that. The generation today is really different. My key message to the younger generation really is, it's 25, 50 times more competitive than where we were before. And the reason for that is because of the advent of AI and singularity. Those are competing for your job. Together with that, you know, there's just so many things which are happening in this world that I think the younger generation should take more seriously. But having said that, they are a generation where, you know, you need to gain their respect for them to listen to you, you know. So we do it in that manner. But at the end of the day, my life was built around the learning process, the knowledge transfer, being able to listen to the world around me. So I'm a very observant person. I want to learn from other people. I want to learn from the environment that I work in and play in. I love the silence, and I love to listen to what's going on around me, and that's where I've survived, you know. So hopefully it's something that they can understand.
Yeah. So no, Paul, thank you for that great advice. So listen, that is basically what I'm hearing. It was a great opportunity to listen to your insights, Paul. So I want to thank you so much for this interview. And
thank you
with achieving your goal to reach, well, support 1 billion people by 2040. Thank you.
Yes, it's an ambitious plan, but I think, you know, we are a world with an 8 billion population now. So being able to target that percentage, I think, is the least we can do. If we fall short, it would still be a high number, so we're confident that we can make a difference with what we're doing. So thank you, Fritz.
Hey, your success. Talk to you later. Thank you.
Thank you, Fritz.
Thank you for listening to the brand called You Videocast and Podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the brand called You.